Chapter 23, The Three-Legged Stool of Delusion. His mind slid away into the labyrinthine world of doublethink. To know and not to know, to be conscious of complete truthfulness while telling carefully constructed lies, to hold simultaneously two opinions which canceled out, knowing them to be contradictory and believing in both of them, to use logic against logic, to forget whatever it was necessary to forget, then to draw it back into memory again at the moment when it was needed, and then promptly to forget it again, and above all, to apply the same process to the process itself. That was the ultimate subtlety, consciously to induce unconsciousness, and then once again to become unconscious of the act of hypnosis you had just performed. Even to understand the word doublethink involved the use of doublethink. George Orwell, 1984. It's Bob's last day in Mexico. He appears at my table and eyes the advanced reading copy of his book sitting in one of the piles, but doesn't ask me if I've looked at it yet. In fact, I have, but not for long. It doesn't take me long to detect and assess ego, whether in people or in their works. I could easily and confidently separate 100 New Thought books into a reject pile and a further look pile in 10 minutes. 8 if I didn't have to neatly stack the rejects. And then winnow the small further look pile down in another couple of minutes, leaving me with, probably, 2 or 3 books I'd want to spend another minute with, of which maybe one, but probably none, would prove a rewarding find. I mentioned in Damnedest that I could meet a person and know very quickly, within a few words, where they were currently located in the spiritual terrain. This is that, this ability to make fast, accurate judgments, especially about printed material, is something I developed early in my own process, which is why I mention it here. Anyone with a strong grasp of Enlightenment theory could do it. I found it to be a very valuable tool. It saved me from wasting time and energy treating books and their authors with respect, based on the respect in which they were held by those whose respect I didn't respect. Also useful was manifestation, the ability to ask for and receive and recognize what I needed when I needed it. Between these two budding talents, I was able to get what I needed and not get lost in the mountains of books and teachings and groups and philosophies competing for my attention. With Bob's book, I made a greater than usual effort to be appreciative and constructively critical. I went through it with a highlighter at first, marking phrases and claims that seemed particularly underwhelming, that he might wish to revise or reconsider or rephrase. But I only got a few pages before the futility of the task sank in. I spent another few minutes scanning through the rest of the book and set it aside. It was essentially a rehash of the same old gurus and teachings, the same old ideals and platitudes. Plenty of heart and soul and equanimity and serenity, plenty of peace and compassion, love and beauty, but not a sharp or pointed thought to be found. Just the standard New Age prattle, a soft, sweet marshmallow of a book. In other words, I realized, Bob just wants to be a teacher. He's put in his time, he's learned the talk, and now he wants to move to the next level. Bob's book will probably be popular and catapult him up into the ranks of successful and respected spiritual authors, teachers. It has all the right elements. It's nice and fuzzy and warm. It demands nothing of the reader except to recommend that they perform the usual techniques and practices, meditation, journaling, witnessing, etc. It assures the reader that they can achieve profound liberation in a moment. Just by realizing something or releasing something or something like that. No real change is necessary. No renunciation or sacrifice is called for. Nothing difficult or demanding or even inconvenient is required. It promises the world, and it has a pretty moral. We are love. In short, standard have your cake and eat it too boilerplate. Of course, market forces are at work, and you have to give the people what they want if you want them to want you. It didn't used to be this way. With all this unseemly pandering to opinion and competition, with all manner of contenders and wannabes. Blame it on Gutenberg with his printing press and Al Gore with his internet. Catholics, as one example, held a monopoly for centuries in parts of the world, and so firm was their grip that they could, in the name of suppressing heresy, torture and kill their own adherents. Nowadays, in our climate of informed alternatives, they can barely get away with suppressing heresy by sodomizing young boys. How the mighty have fallen. Bob has asked me to discuss his book with him on a point-by-point basis, to address the particulars of what I consider its merits and shortcomings. He sounds reasonable when he says it, but there's no getting around the fact that the transition Bob writes about is one that he himself has not undergone. Lisa has undergone it, or is undergoing it, and that's what it looks like. Not the pretty picture Bob paints about how love is our true nature and all we have to do is go into the silence and let go of our negative whatever and embrace our positive whatever so our inner whatever can whatever. Bob wants to give enlightenment back to the people. Yes, enlightenment is the word he uses, although quiet reverie or mild trance or grinning stupor is usually what he describes, and a shallow, undeveloped human adulthood is, at the very most, what he means. He feels enlightenment has been unfairly taken from the people and made the exclusive province of, well, the enlightened. He sees an injustice in that and seeks remedy by acting as the self-appointed spiritual Robin Hood who steals it back from the elite and returns it to the unfairly deprived. He wants to bring enlightenment down from the mountaintop to the valley, where everyone can enjoy it. Spiritual socialism. The enlightenment, of which Bob speaks and writes, is of an ordinary, everyday quality. He provides a list of myths and misconceptions about enlightenment, which serve to rule out anything that would make it seem other than a minor garden-variety epiphany. His book is a who's who of spiritual authors and teachers who hold the same or similar views about how being awake and being enlightened and being happy are all the same thing, and how the reason no one can ever find any of these things is because they're looking for them. And how the great paradox is that in order to find what we're searching for, we have to stop searching for it. That kind of thing. And it's probably true. If what someone is searching for is contentment, then it seems like a good idea, at least on the face of it, to tell them to stop being discontent. That their problem isn't that they lack something they want, but that they want something they lack. And that as soon as they stop wanting it, they'll stop lacking it. That would be fine if they were just talking about contentment and happiness. And by they, I mean the roster of authors and teachers who make their livings and their reputations espousing this line of jailhouse orthodoxy, keep making it about enlightenment, awakening, Buddhahood, and truth. There's nothing new or surprising in all this. This is the standard operating procedure of protective ignorance. Just another day at the office for Maya. How do you keep people in jail without locks? By keeping them from becoming discontent. Easily done. The problem, as they see it, is that spiritual seekers think they must climb to the mountaintop where, they assume, such peak individuals as Buddha and Jesus reside. But the seekers aren't making a very good job of it, which is a pretty safe way to interpret total failure. Rather than revising their ideas about Jesus, Buddha, and mountaintops, Bob's breed of spiritual solution provider seeks to fix the problem by switching labels. Now the valley is the mountaintop, and everyone is enlightened if they go along with the switch. The new goal is right here, right now, and need only be recognized as such. Voila! Total failure is now total success. Peace is war. Captivity is freedom. Ignorance is knowledge. Asleep is awake. This is so Orwellian, so brazen yet subtle, so elegantly representative of the self-deceit of which the fear-based mind is capable, that it arouses in me powerful feelings of admiration and respect for Maya. I say this without any trace of irony. I can't think of anything more fascinating or lovely or worthy of appreciation than Maya, the architect of delusion, the intelligence of fear, our beloved Big Brother. Bob wants to talk, but it's time to take Maya for a walk, so I invite him to come along. My knee still needs help on these hilly excursions, so I grab a hiking staff and the ball flinger and a bottle of water, and we head out. Early in Orwell's 1984, protagonist Winston Smith is sitting in a cafeteria contemplating the various personality types around him. They're different, but what they have in common is that they're all managing to believe what is, to Winston, unbelievable. One manages to believe through sheer stupidity, another through zealotry, and a third, the most intelligent, through the mental complexities of doublethink. And sitting in their midst is poor, hopelessly sane Winston, who knows that 2 + 2 = 4, but who is surrounded by people who know with greater certainty that 2 + 2 = 5. All of them living in a world where you get tortured and killed for believing, even in your most secret heart, that 2 + 2 = 4. Believing the lie is absolutely necessary to their survival, and Winston's fatal flaw is that he can't do it. Bob is a unique blend of all three types: stupid, as in protectively ignorant; zealous, as in the emotional reinforcement of ignorance; and intelligent, as incapable of the strenuous mental contortions necessary to believe the obviously untrue. That is the three-legged stool of delusion, and Bob, like everyone, sits squarely upon it. Unlike everyone, however, Bob has declared himself an authority on truth and has written a book on the subject. Regardless of what comes from it, his hope, when writing it, was that it would be well received and that he would rise from the swollen ranks of students to the less puffy ranks of teachers, from sheep to shepherd, from common inmate to respected trustee. We exit through the north gate and follow roads and trails up into the hills toward an old chapel. For the first 10 minutes, it's all uphill and not conducive to talk. Maya is off prowling around, sniffing every third rock. There are perils for a dog out here, and I'm only semi-ready for an emergency. But she's a smart girl and hasn't come close to getting into trouble yet. Once leveled off, we walk and talk for a few minutes, circling around the edges of tricky subjects. The problem with talking to Bob has been that we don't have a workable dynamic. If we were student-teacher, that would be fine because I could muscle him around a bit and he would know not to resist too much. As it is, he wants to think we're having a peer-to-peer dialogue, which leaves me in a bit of confusion as to what to say and why to say it. The world is full of false and artificial authority. To my casual observation, true authority comes from knowledge, and false authority comes from might. Badges and guns, titles and offices, money and rank, these are a few of the things that bestow upon people a power and privilege to which they have no independent claim. They are the outward sources of a power for which there is no inner source. In spirituality, titles and garb and fancy names serve a similar purpose. With Bob, even though we've had a few hours together every day for almost a week, there is still this slight friction in our conversation because he wants his authority recognized, and I have no capacity to do so. He has written a book. That's his badge, the tangible symbol of his authority. He has found that most people respect the badge and grant the authority. But this is a place of sharp blades, where skill and mastery are everything, and costume and showmanship are nothing. I like Bob, and he is very useful to me. So I have to remember when I talk with him that he has consigned himself to a sort of gray area where he can neither speak nor listen. "Do you have a question?" I ask when the terrain permits. "What should my question be?" he says. "What do I need to know?" Not a bad question on the face of it, but actually a strategic evasion. "The short answer is human adulthood," I tell him. "What's the long answer?" he asks. "The books," I say. "Read the books." "Okay," he says. "I plan to read them. But while I have you here, while we're walking along together, anything you say, regardless of my feelings, I'd be very receptive." I sigh. He's learned to play me over the last few days. "That's very commendable, Bob. I understand that you're a person of deep learning and uncommon spiritual refinement. I've known a lot of people who were very spiritually refined, but they were all still ego-bound. So," I shrug. "You mean like me?" I scoop up a tennis ball in the ball flinger gizmo and give it a long toss. Maya ignores it. "Okay, like me. I get it," he says. "Sorry. Please go on." "You want me to tell you what I think you need to hear," I say. "So I will. Spirituality is the most insidious form of self-delusion, and it's got you. Spirituality is Maya at her most cunningly self-preserving, ego at its most deeply entrenched. That's what you're up against. That's what has you trapped. Spirituality hangs over the world like a pall, like an oily black smoke being pumped into the atmosphere by smokestacks sticking up from millions of churches and universities and monasteries and temples, from bookstands and magazine racks and websites. I look at you and I see a lifelong consumer of this smoke who now wants to get into the manufacturing and distribution end of the business." He's silent for a minute. "I just have a really hard time believing all that," he says. "Yes," I say. "I think that's my point." But it doesn't seem like an oily black smoke, he persists. It seems like people trying to find meaning and happiness, trying to live life in accord with higher laws, trying to live in harmony with the earth and their fellow man, trying to raise children, to be better people, better custodians of the planet. I don't know how you can compare the kind of evolved, life-positive, non-denominational sort of spirituality I'm describing with an oily black smoke. I just don't see it. That's my perception from the outside looking in, I say. From within, I know, it seems sweet and pleasant and good, something desirable and comforting. Naturally so. Nature of the beast. He ponders. I limp. Maya sniffs. So, Bob continues, I'm saying there are all these people who are living these harmonious, spiritually elevated lives, and you're saying they're living in some sort of smoke? I don't mean it in a bad way, I say. This is what Maya does. This is how she holds the whole thing together. This is the critical service she performs. You endow Maya with a great deal of power and intelligence. Actually, you do. I cut her off years ago. I was speaking figuratively, he says. I wasn't. He doesn't reply. Maya is inside you, animating you, right now, I continue. If I seem impatient with you at times, it's because you think I'm talking to you, and I know I'm talking to her. You believe you're awake, and I see that you're asleep. What's the point of us having this conversation? I don't know, but it's what I do, and you asked, so here we are. So I'm standing in this oily... It's not just that you're standing in the oily black smoke. It's that you've been breathing it in deeply for years, and now it suffuses your entire system from the inside out. In through your lungs and your pores, so that now you radiate it back out in the form of your words and your writings. It has seeped into every cell of your being so completely that you have no awareness of it, like the air, like water to a fish. It's the medium in which you exist. You don't know anything else. Well, says Bob with an uncomfortable laugh, I must be in here somewhere. Must you? Then maybe that's what you want to be looking for, this alleged self of yours that must be in there somewhere. Well, maybe that's what I'm trying to do, find this inner self. Or maybe that's what you're trying not to do. I keep throwing balls for Maya, but she's more interested in sense, so I have to chase them down myself. We take a break on a hilltop with some nice views. I pour some water in a folding bowl for Maya. Then Bob and I drink. You know, he says, there are a lot of myths about enlightenment. They say that anyone who claims to be enlightened automatically isn't, or that there's no such thing as enlightenment. I agree with that, I say. You do? Sure. Enlightenment is untruth, unrealization, and self is an untruth. You can't have both. It's one or the other. So who does that leave to be enlightened? No self is true self. Despite the apparent paradox, being enlightened means that there's no one left to be enlightened. But you claim to be enlightened. Within the context of our current metaphor, I claim that I'm not in the blinding smoke. The thing to remember is that, regardless of any and all claims to the contrary, there is no visibility in the smoke. No one can see anything. And the most significant thing no one can see is that no one can see anything. Some people say they can see, and if they tell a good story, And if they believe it themselves, then they can get others to believe it as well. That suits Maya's purposes, and there are rewards for doing it. Nearly all spiritual teachers fall into that category, the blind leading the blind. Once you can see, you can easily see who else can and who can't. There's no room for debate. "Me?" he asks. "You what?" "I'm in the smoke, pretending I can see." "Of course," I reply. "But not you. I'm not a teacher. I have no students. I have no teaching." "But what's the difference then? You're here with the rest of us. You see what everyone else sees." "I'm not, and I don't." "But we're here together, right now," he says. "I'm looking at you. You're looking at me. You see me." "You're a mirage, Bob. I see through you. I'm a mirage. I see through me." I gesture to indicate the lovely view. "It's all a mirage. I see through everything. Just to clarify, this oily black smoke isn't just the medium in which the spiritually benighted ego resides. It is the ego itself, the stuff of which ego is made. There is no distinction to be drawn between deceiver, deceit, and deceived. Until we understand the egoic condition, there's really no chance of making any actual progress." "You know," he says, "there are quite a few highly respected teachers who say there is no progress to make, that that's the illusion, that we're already fully awake, already enlightened, and that we just have to stop struggling and searching. What we seek is what we already are, and it's only our searching that blinds us to that truth." I can't find the heart to respond to that. Everything Bob is saying about modern spirituality dovetails with my own views, only with a reverse spin. Where he sees tranquility and equanimity, I see docility and unconsciousness. Where he sees advancement, I see entrenchment. Whenever I venture to take a look at what's current and popular in New Age and spiritual thought, all I find is the same dumbed-down, watered-down, sickly, sweet slop. It's as if everyone was dining from a common trough, and the special of the day is just a matter of who regurgitated last. I try to tough it out, but the experience is ill-making, like radiation exposure, and only tolerable in small doses. When I get over my sour reaction, I remind myself that if I can't stand the smell, I shouldn't stick my head in the sewer. There are exceptions, of course, which is why I go back and check once in a while, always looking for someone with true authority and direct knowledge and the power of expression. I put the water away and we continue walking. I pay silent tribute to the supreme and subtle mastery of Maya, the goddess of delusion, not the dog. This is her show. She has it locked down tight, and nowhere is her influence stronger than where you'd expect it to be weakest. Chapter 24. Alternative People. There seem to be two kinds of searchers. Those who seek to make their ego something other than it is, for example, holy, happy, unselfish, as though you could make a fish unfish, and those who understand that all such attempts are just gesticulation and play acting, and that there is only one thing that can be done, which is to disidentify themselves with the ego by realizing its unreality, and by becoming aware of their eternal identity with pure being. We Woo We. Bob picks up some stones and tosses them off into the brush as we walk. To me, this is just idle gab. To Bob, it's an assault on the foundation of his carefully crafted and heavily fortified egoic structure, his Bobness. After a few minutes, he tries another tack. Jed, seriously, I think you've got it wrong about the present spiritual climate in the world. You're being very contemptuous of something you don't really seem to understand. Human spirituality isn't this dinosaur trapped in the past. It's an evolutionary process, and it's happening right now, all over the world. We can change the world, make it a better place for everyone. Maybe I'm not talking about people who are fully enlightened the way you think of it, but people who are awake in their own right. All sorts of very inspired people, artists and musicians, teachers and parents, people full of loving kindness and open hearts and fundamental decency who have seen that the path of the heart has its own riches and rewards. Intelligent, successful, thoughtful people. I try to cut him off, but he cuts me off. Let me continue, he continues. I'm talking about deeply authentically spiritual people who live life in the moment while adapting to a changing future, who create art and green businesses and wholesome, happy families, people who aren't part of the great herd of humanity mindlessly squandering their lives and our planetary resources, people who have escaped the rat race and found a better way. These are people of awareness and vision who understand the predicament in which humanity finds itself, socially, politically, environmentally, and are leading this revolution, Jed. They are leading the way into a new world order? Yes, oh, okay, a new world order, a new kind of humanity, of human community. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I understand what you're saying about the old ways, but what you're not seeing is that it's already happening, I say. Yes, that this revolution is taking place right now, and it's not about Buddhist or Hindu or New Age ideology or any particular school or doctrine. It's not limited to any one viewpoint, but embraces all ideologies in the sense and to the degree that they respect the individual and the family and the rights of people to follow their own path and pursue their happiness. It's about a new approach to life based on deeply held universal values and principles common to all. There's a global spiritual renaissance. Exactly. A global spiritual renaissance taking place. I stop walking and scowl at him. But he has some weird glow of righteousness that makes him immune. The theme he's expounding is prominent in his book and seems to call for the uniting of many different fringe belief systems, those falling into the gray zone between major religions and wacko cults, into a cohesive movement which could lead mankind into a better tomorrow. As far as I can make out, the common trait shared by these people and groups is their tolerance for all points of view. 2 plus 2 equals whatever anyone says it does. Everyone is right. All beliefs are true. In any event, what he's talking about, even if it were true or likely, has nothing to do with me and what I talk and write about, except that both our subjects fall under the broad rubric of human spirituality. They are unrelated. I am completely indifferent to all of his stated ideals, and he is completely unacquainted with my views. I've made several attempts to impress this upon him, but people seem to have a special place in their framework for things that are outside their framework, and that seems to be where he has put me. We continue walking. He continues talking. I'm talking about an approach to life that is open and receptive, he goes on, an approach that encourages the processes of of growth and creation and heart expansion. It's all about living lives of love and peace in a way that no society before has been able to accomplish. Do you know how most people live in society today? Like slaves, like mindless automatons going through the motions of life, but not really alive. We enjoy this wonderful level of abundance and prosperity that allows us to realize the dream of a new dawn for mankind, a transformation of consciousness. All of the great wisdom teachings point to this. That's why I think of it as a revolution, Jed, an ideological realignment. Together, we can bring about real change, an evolutionary shift. Have you ever heard of the 100th monkey? This is a radical awakening of the species, and it's happening right now. Many thousands of people throughout the world are taking part in this transformation. Millions, probably. This is a very exciting time, Jed, and I don't think you fully realize, but I do. Bob is talking about alternative people, alternative beliefs and outlooks, alternative business and politics, alternative lifestyles and healthcare, alternative child rearing and schooling, alternative fuels and energies, alternative everything, basically, but not very alternative. These are alternatives within the established paradigm, not alternatives to it. A subherd running in parallel to the main body. Rather than detaching from their ego structures, alternative people merely reshape them along more heartfelt and self-centric lines. Their multivarious goals and ideals reducing to personal happiness via the removal, avoidance, and denial of unhappiness. In short, they make the minor course adjustment from orthodox to somewhat less orthodox beliefs. And the one reason underlying the many apparent reasons for this change is always the same. Survival of ego. A chameleon-like adaptability is one of Maya's most effective maneuvers. Paint some trees on the walls of your cell and some clouds on the ceiling and you're free as a bird. This is the status of the would-be spiritual aspirant in the world today. Spirituality is merely an alternative religion. The same lines filled in with similar colors from a slightly different palette. It fulfills the same needs as religion, makes the same undemanding demands, and offers the same vague promises and rewards. It also enjoys the same curious immunity from accountability enjoyed by the religions and wacko cults it falls between, such that users blame failure on themselves and not the belief package they bought or the people who sold it to them. In the end, all three groups, major religions, wacko cults, and the gooey middle, are just minor variations of the one true religion of man, agnosticism, without knowledgeism. Bob's alternative people have convinced themselves that they have escaped from incarceration when they have merely burrowed from one cell into another and labeled the new one freedom. In this prison of ego, worldview, and cell decor, are synonymous. Many live in perpetual dissatisfaction with their cell and seek remedy by introducing new and exciting decorative touches. A swatch of Buddhism here, a dab of Sufism there, a little mystic poetry to brighten a drab corner, and maybe a little Native American splash to give it some local color. Always shopping, always looking for that perfect thing to fill that empty space, finding it and then growing tired of it and returning to the search. This chronic urge to spruce up one's surroundings provides the lifeblood of the spiritual marketplace, which is, at all levels, nothing more than a prison cell design boutique. Whether you're in the market for Christian Gothic, New Age Eclectic, or Apocalyptic Chic, they've got what you're looking for. Being an alternative person is a luxury not available to everyone. It takes disposable time and disposable money. Welfare moms and migrant workers aren't the ones buying organic tofu or chakra tuning forks or hemp luggage sets or, frankly, my books. Peasants only do Tai Chi where it's mainstream. Not everyone can afford to take off for a month of energy healing at Esalen, or a week of swimming with dolphins, or even a day to skinny dip in the Dalai Lama's vast ocean of wisdom. Of course, anyone can meditate for free. Even if you're poor, you can sit down and close your eyes and repeat a mantra or count your breaths for a few minutes. But realistically, without a dedicated sacred space stocked with imported incense, hand-tufted cushions, authentic replica temple bells, and an alabaster Kuan Yin statue on a museum-quality mahogany altar where, clad in loose-fitting, vegetable-dyed, organic cotton yoga robes, you can work toward your spiritual salvation in a manner befitting so austere a pursuit. Oh, what chance do you really have? Sure, you can put on flannel jammies, lock yourself in the bathroom, light up that old boysenberry delight candle that's been in there since the fan broke, scrunch some towels under your butt, and place the Snoopy bath toy reverently upon the porcelain altar. But seriously, who's that gonna fool? Not you. And that brings us to the golden rule of all spiritual practices. If you're not fooling yourself, what's the point? The true goal of all spiritual practices is to keep yourself fooled, to maintain the self-deception, to see what's not and not see what is. That's why the stated goals are always unverifiable and ill-defined. It's not about attaining them. It's about pursuing them. Who wants to wake up? When we have a little itch that threatens to awaken us in the night, we want to scratch the itch and make it go away, not let it evict us from our slumbers. Same thing here. In this sense, spiritual practice, meditation, for instance, is 100% effective. If a spiritual practice satisfies your urge to do something spiritual, if it makes you think you're making progress, if it scratches your itch without disturbing your slumber, then it's doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing. What to say? And why to say it? I ponder these questions as Bob and I begin the downhill return leg of our walk. He keeps pushing his ideas of a spiritually elevated humanity, and I keep pushing back. More from habit, I suppose, than from any hope or belief that I'll get through to him. I know our discussion will probably make it into the book, so I have that in mind. Otherwise, I'd be at a total loss as to what to say and why to say it. You and your alternative people seem married to this idea that we're playing by some sort of point system, I tell Bob when it's my turn again, as if you're working toward a karmic degree or prizes in a cosmic gift catalog. Like some glorious, eternal vacation package in a place where the rules you don't like don't apply. You're tinkering around on the surface with the petty cosmetic issues. But the real stuff you have to deal with is inside you, in as deep as you go, which is a lot deeper than you know until you do go. You asked me to tell you, Bob, so I'm telling you. I know these spiritual people you're talking about. I've known many spiritual people from many paths and systems. I see them with eyes you possess, but have never used. They're dilettantes, dabblers, hobbyists, deserters from their own lives. This isn't measured in opinion, but in progress. Their spirituality is on the surface only, an egoic embellishment, an evasive tactic. It's better to look different, they think, than to be different. Spirituality is something that's supposed to improve our lives, they suppose, not derail them. He's shaking his head as if I'm still not getting it. He starts to protest, but I press on. You disagree with me, I continue, because you've never seen where real spiritual battles are waged, where spiritual progress is like slowly and methodically skinning yourself with a straight razor, one layer at a time, each more painful than the last. You've convinced yourself that ego is something small and trite, like it's a habit you can kick. Imagine having your head cut off. Then imagine it not in a single chop, but in small pieces. Then imagine doing it yourself. He grimaces. You don't even know about such things. The money and the crowds flow toward pretty fairy tales, where everything is beautiful and everyone lives happily ever after. A fairy tale is what everyone wants. So that's what everyone gets, and it's ego that lives happily ever after. All the while, we're walking, and I'm throwing balls for Maya, who gives joyous pursuit before being lured back to all the strange and exciting scents along the path, leaving me to hobble around collecting the balls and throw them again. Your assessment seems unduly pessimistic, he says half-heartedly. I wouldn't characterize it that way, I say, because I don't see anything as wrong. But yes, ultimately, my assessment is that people exist in such a marginal state that it's more like coma than life. So I guess that sounds pessimistic. I'd be happy to stop talking. Go on, please, says Bob in a quiet voice. We're getting into a curvy area of the path with limited visibility. Do you see Maya? I ask. Not the way you do, he says, but from what I understand, my dog, Bob, do you see my dog? I let out a short whistle, and after a few seconds she comes bounding around a corner behind us and straight into hot tennis ball pursuit. For many sincere people like yourself, I continue, spirituality is a walk in the park on a sunny day, bubbling with pretty notions of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. It's softcore spirituality, full of soft focus and soft lighting and soft music, everything soft and fluffy, all moving towards some earth-shaking climax that never seems to materialize. Anyone involved in the actual process of awakening would view such frivolity the way men on a bloody battlefield view children playing war in backyards. You talk about a revolution, but revolutions aren't like afternoon tea parties with fine china and extended pinkies. They're hellish nightmares from which you can't wake up. Real spirituality is a savage insurrection, the oppressed rising up in a do-or-die bid for freedom. It's not something people do to improve themselves or earn merit or impress friends or to find greater joy and meaning in life. It's a suicidal assault on a foe of unimaginable superiority. like David and Goliath, he suggests. Actually, yes. Good parable. Our Goliath is large and powerful and cunning and all-seeing. Our David is puny and weak and stupid and blind. He has no advantage in this fight whatsoever, except the heart to fight and his rock. We can think of the rock as truth, and truth is the giant killer. Truth destroys everything. Goliath has every power and advantage except truth. And that's why we can fight and win. We have truth and Maya doesn't. Still, it's not a one-shot deal where David throws the rock and Goliath tips over dead. It's a long, ugly struggle because we are both friend and foe. Both David and Goliath reside within. Every inch of ground takes everything we have. Lessons aren't delivered as quaint little parables and allegories, but as irreparable losses, lesson after lesson, loss after loss. Every step is a loss, and as long as there's more to lose, there are more steps to take. Everything is lost. Nothing is gained. So you're saying I should... Not at all, Bob. I'm not inciting you to revolt or to launch an insurrection. The Dream State is a big amusement park, and I would never encourage anyone to try to escape. That would be as absurd as suggesting that you commit suicide for your own good. Bob is silent for a few moments. Gosh, he says. Chapter 25. Carnivalesque. A childlike man is not a man whose development has been arrested. On the contrary, he is a man who has given himself a chance of continuing to develop long after most adults have muffled themselves in the cocoon of middle-aged habit and convention. Aldous Huxley. Death was in the air. I've had two people in my life who were critical in helping me handle my modest financial concerns. Neither actually did anything or charge anything, as far as I could tell. Yet between them, they got everything done and got themselves paid for doing it. Clark was a lunch man, and Norman was a phone man. Both were from a different area of New York City. Both were already in semi-retirement and practically like family when I was a kid. Clark died a few years ago, and Norman, the winking, brandy-drinking, cravat-wearing, gin-rummy chap, died shortly before I was to travel to Virginia with Lisa's help and eulogize Brett. It was Norman I called when I wanted to buy the Ahihi's house and needed to convert my few assets to cash with the most speed and least loss and tax consequence. I gave him legal power to act for me, and he devised and implemented a solution that gave me what I needed in the time frame I needed it. But Norman's passing left some loose ends, so I had to make a trip to New York and New Canaan to finalize things. I was staying in a bed and breakfast in Connecticut when my newly acquired and much despised disposable phone started chirping. It was Lisa, calling to let me know her dad, Frank, had passed away. A heart attack in his sleep, she said. She had to get the body back to the States for services and burial in the family plot alongside her mother, who had died the previous year. Naturally, I excused her from any obligations she felt regarding our trip to Virginia, but she assured me she wanted more than ever to make that trip, and that, since we were both already in the States, maybe we could get together a few days early and make a more relaxed trip of it. We managed to hook up at Reagan National just outside D.C. I had asked her to rent a comfortable sedan, but she upgraded us to a very stately black Lincoln Navigator, explaining that she wanted this trip to be special and that she'd pay the difference. It's only a few hundred miles, and we could make it a straight shot. But we decided to stretch it out to over 500 miles and 2 days by heading east first, then leisurely southward and westward, stopping and taking side trips as we felt like it, avoiding larger towns and highways and Civil War tourist hotspots as much as possible. Due to time constraints, our drive back to D.C. will be a straight shot up through the Blue Ridge Highlands and the Shenandoah Valley, driving at night the whole way, which I much prefer. Not only are Lisa and I saying goodbye to other people in our lives at this time, we're saying goodbye to each other as well. Once we get back to the airport, I'll be getting on a plane, and that's probably the last we'll see of each other. We drive most of the morning, not in any hurry. We stop for a late lunch and wash down Chesapeake oysters with cold beer on a veranda overlooking the docks of a quaintly run-down marina. I can't say it to her, but I am aware that Lisa has become, over the course of the few months I've known her, a very attractive person. That doesn't come as a surprise to me. I've seen many artificially attractive people become authentically attractive as they underwent the early stages of the transition from artificial to authentic personhood. When we met, Lisa was very pretty in the professional woman, urban, suburban, always on the go, soccer mom sense, everything just so. Makeup subtle but ever-present, hair in a low-maintenance cut and always done, outfit always carefully selected and accessorized. Now, she has left all that behind. And at the same time, it has all become unnecessary. She has come into herself. And now her attractiveness radiates from within rather than from department stores and health clubs, and from a morning hair and makeup routine. She looks great in jeans and tennis shoes and a t-shirt, hair pulled back or loose. She's happier and healthier, and she looks it. During the first few weeks of her stay with me in Mexico, she underwent a profound physical transformation as her body saw a rare opportunity and seized it. She was initially distraught to find herself battling a whole slew of low-grade symptoms, her discomfort worsened by overall anxiety. It was all quite normal in my experience, and I reassured her and encouraged her to relax into the process and trust it. Her body was taking advantage of this opportunity to bring itself back into alignment after years of being overstretched in all directions. She was releasing a lot of stored-up toxins and dealing with the compounding effect of processing them all at once. For someone who has been eating and sleeping poorly, who has had their nerves frazzled by ever-present electromagnetic fields, who's been bombarded from all directions by deranging images and messages in all forms of media, who has been constantly suffocated under the pressures of work and family and the clock, for whom even vacations are structured madness, and who, above all, considers this state normal and healthy, for someone like this, true relaxation can be like its own rebirth. The most noticeable thing is sleep. The first thing the body wants to do is shut down. And people who haven't slept more than 5 or 6 straight hours in years, or decades, are shocked to find themselves sleeping deeply and untroubled for 10 or 12 hours at a stretch, night after night, in addition to long naps during the day. They assume it's something mystical or spiritual, and it is, but not the way they think, just in the ordinary mystical and spiritual way of things. They're not just sleeping, but sleeping well, and waking up deeply rested and content in a way that feels new and wonderful and surprising to them. They are revitalized and rejuvenated. It's something they may not have experienced since their childhood and may not have thought possible. This seems to be mainly a matter of how severely bent out of shape they've gotten themselves. Once the body is allowed to repair and heal itself back into its natural state, a whole host of dramatic changes begin taking place. Tastes change and bad habits naturally fall away. Years fall away from the appearance. Pounds fall away too, and healthy skin tone and muscle tone return. Not all on the first day, of course, but surprisingly quickly. It's amazing how resilient and forgiving the body can be. In Lisa's case, there were also some chemical challenges to overcome. Her body had developed an over-fondness for coffee and diet soda and a few prescription medications, and it took about a month for her to be comfortably weaned off of them to the point where she could have a cup of regular octane coffee with me in the morning and leave it at that. I don't know what her alcohol habits were, but I got that sense that a couple of glasses of wine a couple of times a week represented a reduction. This, quite naturally, can also be a very challenging time emotionally, and Lisa looked to me for answers. So I gave her a mantra. Rest. Breathe. Water. Walk. Rest. Breathe. Water. Walk. Rest. Breathe. Water. Walk. The mind is much slower to rid itself of toxic thoughts than the body is to reclaim its health. Lisa underwent an inner conflict stemming from her deeply ingrained attitudes about productivity and time management. Sleeping half the day was lazy and unconscionable. Naps were an affront to her work ethic. Not doing something at all times was a major challenge for her. Just getting to the place where she could see that it might not be necessary to be in a constant state of busyness was a struggle. In the first week I knew her, just to actually sit still for 5 minutes would have made her crazy. Simply agreeing that doing nothing now and then might not be too horrible was a major concession. She's much better now, but the productivity bug still infects her system. This just gives a small idea of the transformation people undergo when they stop subjecting themselves to the endless barrage of assaults and stresses so many people find normal. I'm sure there are plenty of good books about the benefits of getting the hell out of that mess and back into one's natural element. So I won't pound on it here except to say that it has been particularly good to Lisa. She is, in virtually every respect, a different, healthier, and more youthful and poised and radiantly attractive person than she was when we met. Still a work in progress, but coming along very nicely. "I still don't see why you need a travel assistant," she says. "Not that I'm not grateful for this opportunity. You just seem perfectly capable of handling all the arrangements for yourself." During this journey with Lisa, I make an effort to be more talkative than I usually am. I share things about myself, little anecdotes, stories from my life, not biographical in content so much as process-related. I'm trying to show her something, to give her a glimpse of how the world really works and how we work in it and with it. There are a few books she'll find useful in the early stages, but she'll quickly move beyond those, and then she'll be alone. For me, this process of discovery was and is a very delightful thing, but our circumstances are very different. I want to leave her with a sense of the spaces she herself can be moving into so that when we part ways, she'll have a sense of her new self and her new place in things and what she is and where she is. It's mostly the dealing with people part. I realized years ago that my contact with, normal people should be kept at a minimum. "It was indicated?" she asks in a playful tone. "Actually, it was," I say. She smiles and nods to encourage me to explain. "Okay," I say. "Let's see. Well, it was in Mexico, actually, in some little dirt town an hour from the border. I don't remember where. I was at the counter in a hotel trying to arrange a replacement for a broken-down rental car. And the woman behind the counter said something about the terrible heat. Anyway, I was trying to dial a call, and without really thinking about it, I said, 'No daría eso si era muerto.' Lisa barks out a loud, shocked laugh. 'You wouldn't say that if you were dead?' 'Yep.' 'Jesus, you said that?' 'Yep.' 'Oh my goodness, Jed, you shouldn't say things like that. People might not be real thrilled to be told something like that.' I wasn't thinking. I was just saying what I'd say to any student back then who complained about trivialities. The point being that every day is the best day. That this isn't a dress rehearsal and all that. I happen to know the phrase in Spanish. I thought it was amusing." "I bet that's not how she took it," she says. "I didn't mean anything by it," I say, feeling a need to explain the blunder. "I never try to be witty or sagely or insightful with strangers. It just popped out, like a standard response you don't even think about. Even to this day, I don't really understand why she was offended, which is why I need a travel assistant, I guess. I can't speak honestly, and I hate talking bullshit, so I'd just rather avoid dealing with people whenever possible." Sonia saw that I'd rather drive nonstop cross-country than deal with ticket agents and hotel clerks and make phone reservations and stand in lines and all that. So she just started sending someone with me, and traveling got 10 times better. This is just one small example. This disconnect between me and normal people comes up all the time in many ways, always stemming from the fact that I am no one thinly disguised as someone. In order to be out and about, interfacing, I have to impersonate myself. I'm very uncomfortable doing that and not very good at it. The disguise is unconvincing, the deception easily detected. People don't know what it is they're detecting, but they know something's not right. They sense it in some way, even if they don't understand it, that I'm an imposter. Bit of irony there, I suppose. Was she offended? Sonia? La Mexicana. Oh, yeah, she freaked out. She thought I was threatening to kill her. Within 5 minutes, the whole town was involved. This was just some impoverished little crossroads town, and here's this gringo threatening to kill a local abuelita. A bar next door emptied out to see what was going on. Her boss comes out of the office carrying a steel pipe. The local police chief shows up, and it turns out he's the woman's brother. They're all yelling at each other, gesturing, consoling the woman, It was quite a scene. Emotions were running remarkably high. Carnivalesque. Oh, my God. Did you explain? I laugh. I couldn't have gotten a word in. The whole scene was crazy. This went on for half an hour. The whole thing had the feel of a Hollywood backlot. All the people seemed straight out of central casting. That's pretty much how I see everyone anyway. But here it was quite pronounced. I just relaxed and tried to enjoy the spectacle. Are you crazy? They thought you were threatening to kill her. I'm surprised they didn't gut you and dump you in the desert. We are in God's hands, brother, not theirs. Brother? Excuse me? Oh, it's just one of those nice cultural references. In Henry V, the Duke of Gloucester is worried that the French will attack when the English are at their weakest. And that's what Harry replies. We are in God's hands, brother, not theirs. Harry was an adult, a king, in a state of surrender, threatening to rape daughters and smash old people's heads and spit babies on pikes while marching his ragtag little army against an overwhelming force, because to do so was clearly indicated. You don't see that represented in books or plays very often. And what does that have to do with you getting gutted by an angry mob? You're subscribing to the belief that they had the power, that the choice was theirs. The idea that someone with a knife or a gun or money or a nuclear arsenal has some sort of power is beyond my powers of make-believe. I couldn't pretend that was true even hypothetically.